Welcome to the second episode of What Exactly Am I Watching Here, a proud member of the Overthink Podcast Network. I'm your host for now, Jason Helms, and I'm joined by my willing guinea pig, Dominic Lang. Say hi, Dom.
Jason, hello. Good evening. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling, oh man. I don't want to date these things too much, but I just saw Clemson beat Auburn, and I'm a Clemson alum, so yes. That was good.
Wow, congratulations. Really, yeah. Congratulations.
And this is the fourth year in a row that Clemson has beat Auburn. So that means, like, you don't know when I recorded this. This could have been, you know, 2016. Yeah.
Well, I salute you with my damn good cup of coffee right here, Jason.
Damn fine coffee. And hot.
Mmm. Rich. All right.
So before we begin, quick introduction to the show. What Exactly Am I Watching Here is a podcast that features an expert, myself, and a novice.
Myself.
Watching one of the great shows of television history, like Obi-Wan guiding Luke, like Miyagi training Daniel, like Virgil guiding Dante by the hand, but where Virgil uses Wikipedia and Netflix to help explain things along the way. For now, our show is the cult favorite Twin Peaks. I am a huge fan of Twin Peaks, and I found out that Dom had never watched it, so I'm really excited to get his reactions to it. So whether you're a newbie like Dom or such a fan that you know what Coop's favorite flavor of chewing gum is, I think you're going to enjoy listening to us make our way through the entire show. If you're starting here, you're starting in the wrong place. We are today talking about episodes 4 through 8, 5 through 8, 4 through 7. The back half of season 1, depending on how you want to number them.
Yes.
So where did we leave off?
So we left off, we just had Laura Palmer's funeral. Laura Palmer's murder and the mystery surrounding that is kind of the backbone for season 1. Everything that's happening is either directly or somewhat kind of tangentially connected to that. Her father, Leland Palmer, is an emotional wreck. We are discovering more and more about the surrounding characters. FBI agent Dale Cooper is hot on the case and is kind of guiding us through and introducing us to the world of Twin Peaks. So we just finished Rest in Pain, which, depending on your episode counting, is episode 3 or episode 4. So we're halfway through season 1.
Yep. So today we're going to take the back half of the season. Before we do so, we're going to do some overall reactions from Dom. Then we'll do a breakdown episode by episode, just going through and covering what happened in each episode. Then we'll talk about some of the characters and some of the themes and kind of just reflect on season 1 in general before getting out of here. So with that, Dom, react. What'd you think of the second half of season 1?
Oh, man. Second half of season 1, I was super impressed. The episodes, I think, upped tension in numerous ways. We were introduced to some new characters that had been hinted at throughout kind of the first few episodes, and some surprise characters. And with each character that was introduced, I felt like they were introduced in such organic ways because they informed past relationships on the show. And so by introducing one character, you learned more about another. And it just made the universe all that richer for it. There are multiple double crosses. Nobody trusts anybody. Nobody is honest with anybody. And I think also just a continual development of the uncanny. Like we talked about that, I think, last time, of just an atmosphere of not quite what you experience every day, but nobody blinks in the, like, no one stops and goes, hey, isn't it kind of strange that, you know, we have a log lady who carries a log around everywhere she goes. Everyone just buys it. Yeah. And in that sense, kind of like nothing's off the table. And so that, I think, gives a lot of momentum. And it's a hell of a finale. I was, again, amazed, impressed. And it's leaving me stoked for season 2.
Sweet. Great to hear. Well, with that, let's go ahead and break down the episodes one by one. And the first one is the one-armed man. So, amazingly, both Cooper and Sheriff Truman managed to locate the one-armed man from Cooper's dream. Meanwhile, Josie Packard follows Ben and Catherine as the couple's conspiracy to destroy the Packard sawmill develops, and Josie then receives a strange message from soon-to-be-paroled Hank Jennings. Yeah. So, where should we begin?
I would love to begin with Hank Jennings.
Okay.
Because Hank seems, again, like really an example of that kind of duplicitous nature of characters on the show, where he's been talked about vaguely, and now you meet him, and he seems to be a reformed convict, you know, gives testimony at his parole hearing, but we end with him calling Josie Packard, and there's obviously some history there. There's obviously some like shady dealing, and any goodwill that he'd built in the parole hearing goes away instantly. So he puts me instantly on edge in this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. The duplicity, I love his domino that he's constantly fiddling with and sucking on and yeah. paying attention to. Not sure what it means, but it kind of reminds me of that duplicitous nature. The interesting thing, though, it's a domino with a three on each side, so it's actually not duplicitous. It's it's the same on both sides. What you see is what you get.
Yeah, yeah. It almost carries it around like a talisman or like a rabbit's foot. And again, like you're not kind of clued into what it means exactly.
Right.
But super fun. Also, this episode has kind of bizarre or eerie as the show is. The shooting style is fairly ordinary. Up until this episode, which has a few at the very end, a few Dutch or canted angles, which are more traditionally used to give that sense of the uncanny or give that sense of darkness or something amiss. And so it's interesting that like we wait 4 or 5 episodes before actually using traditional film techniques to create the uncanny.
And just out of curiosity, what was being shot with those Dutch angles?
It's the very end when Hank calls Josie,
mm-hmm.
and it's Josie answering the phone.
Yeah.
And so there's low lighting, a canted angle. And you saw that a lot in film noir to give, again, that kind of that askew, something's not quite right, something is off in the world feeling.
Yeah.
So.
And it's literally where you turn the camera kind of on its axis so mm-hmm. that things mm-hmm. are viewed diagonally.
Yes.
If that makes sense. I'm trying to describe a visual medium. I'm not sure if that's happening correctly, but yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, one of the things I love about Twin Peaks and David Lynch in general is often the really uncanny stuff, the weird stuff, mm-hmm. is stuff that's really, really normal, and you can't put your finger on what's off about it. And the more I watch this, the more these things jump out to me where I go, wow, that there was something about the way that Cooper looked to his left there that was really off-putting. And I have no idea how Lynch made me feel so odd in that moment, because it's not a scary scene. It's not a scary anything.
Yeah. But
suddenly, and a lot of it, it's kind of that Kubrick shot of centering everything. You know, mm-hmm. everything is right in the middle of the frame.
Yeah.
He does a lot of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm learning along the way.
And also I think it's when the team goes to Jacques Renault's apartment.
Yeah.
You open on a couple playing tennis, and they look to be head to toe covered in like sweats.
Yeah.
It's like a ski mask and long sleeves and everything. And then a whip pans to the police cars, and no one ever mentions the tennis players again.
Yep.
And I think that's for me kind of just the fun, like, the fun intros to scenes, the fact that, again, nobody's blinking in this universe.
Yeah.
No one's going like, whoa, wait a minute. What about this? we just keep on going.
Yeah. Or if someone hesitates, they'll say, yeah, Log Lady's a bit of an oddball, but you know what? She really has a lot of wisdom. Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
I want to find out more about this then. All right, I'm in.
speaking of Log Lady.
Yes.
We get to, I think that's the next episode.
Where
we get to sit down with Log Lady.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
So Episode 5, Cooper's Dreams. Cooper Truman, Deputy Hawk, and Doc Hayward venture into the woods for a revelatory encounter with the Log Lady and find the location of Jacques Renault's cabin. In the meantime, Audrey continues her efforts to assist, and I want to put that in quotes, assist, yeah. Cooper by taking a job at her father's department store, while Donna and James Hurley pursue their own line of inquiry into Laura's death by taking Maddie into their confidence. Elsewhere, Leo's battered wife, Shelley, decides to get revenge.
Yeah, and so this is actually kind of funny. After I watched The One-Armed Man, I was thinking, you know, that was a good episode, but I really missed Cooper giving voice memos to Diane. And I thought, like, man, I kind of missed that. I missed that, like, kind of quirky, just, like, personal insight into Cooper. And the first scene of Cooper's Dreams is Diane. And I was like, yes, Diane, I missed you so much.
And to be clear,
yes,
we still have not seen Diane.
Yeah,
let me make that very clear.
But I missed her. All the same,
yes.
I missed her. I missed the
yes.
unheard, unseen, unknown Diane.
Absolutely. So,
and yeah, Audrey's assisting Cooper, I think it's very wise to put that in quotes because it very much seems, I guess Audrey's intentions or Audrey's motivations, definitely she's crushing hard on Agent Cooper. But beyond that, I'm not sure how vested she is in solving Laura's murder.
Yeah, she's playing at being a detective.
Mm.
Partially because of the crush on Agent Cooper, and partially because she's 18 and she's playing at being an adult and trying to find out what that is. But I think that's one thing that I really like about this is the teenagers in it. Although they are all played clearly by people in their mid to late 20s.
Yes.
Which is hilarious and great.
Yeah.
The teenagers are trying so hard to be serious. They're trying so hard to be adults. And I think even that 50s nostalgia vibe that it gives you is just reminding you of teenagers trying to be serious. And I had forgotten that that's so much of what being in high school is taking everything really, really seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you wind up kind of almost like the image of wearing shoes that are a few sizes too big.
Yeah.
And you very quickly and very easily get in over your head on situations.
Yep, yep.
One of my favorite shots is there's what feels like the Mount Rushmore shot of, it's a side profile of Coop, Hawk, Truman, and Doc Hayward, all when they see Jacques Renault's cabin.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of arrival moment. And it's where we meet Waldo, the minor bird.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So where's Waldo? Jacques Renault's cabin.
Jacques Renault's cabin.
Yeah.
At long last, we haven't quite answered who killed Laura Palmer, but we have answered where's Waldo. He's in Jacques' cabin.
Perfect.
And this episode ends on quite the cliffhanger. Coop comes back into his room at the Great Northern, turns on the light.
Yep.
And who should we see but Audrey Horne?
Not Waldo.
Not Waldo. Waldo's back at the station. We see Audrey Horne in Coop's bed. And not much else is in the bed.
Yeah, just wearing nothing but Coop's covers, it seems
yes,
like.
Yes, yes. So, quite the cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And Audrey, yeah, any mystery as to her intention seems to have vanished by this point.
Along with her clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we start to fall into now this pattern of cliffhangers.
Yes.
That I don't remember being as intense in the first few episodes. The first few episodes, there was a lot more learning who people are. The plot was driving forward a little bit, but just the general mystery of Laura Palmer was enough to keep us hooked. And now it seems like we're getting a weekly cliffhanger with each episode.
Mm-hmm. Which I think goes back to something you said last pod about how the original intent was to veer away from a central mystery.
Right.
And so we could have cliffhangers that weren't directly correlated to the Laura Palmer investigation.
Yeah. And the extent to which this works as a cliffhanger, I think, tells you how well the show is working for you. Yeah. In the sense that if you're like, oh, wait, she's in Coop's bed, but can we get back to the mystery?
Yeah.
Then you know, this show is not going to work for you. No. If you're like, ooh, hey, what's going to happen next time? Right. She's in Coop's bed. Then this show is going to be perfect. You may be able to solve the mystery of Laura Palmer along the way, but the thing that's going to hook you is these kinds of cliffhangers, the week to week stuff.
Definitely, definitely. And I think that takes, for me, that takes us right into realization time.
Yep.
The next episode.
Yep. All right. So on to episode 6, realization time. Agent Cooper goes undercover at One-Eyed Jack's along with Big Ed Hurley to try to find his chief murder suspect, Jacques Renault. Unbeknownst to Cooper, however, Audrey Horne, too, is undercover as a hostess. Meanwhile, Maddie, Donna, and James engage in a scheme to fool Dr. Jacoby and steal a tape recorded by Laura prior to her death. And Bobby, still jealous about Laura having an affair, sets out to ruin James. All right, jump on in.
So this is where things really started to, like, ramp up tension-wise for me.
Yeah.
Because it felt like every scene, it felt like kind of the circle was narrowing in. And everybody, like, it felt like everyone was going to wind up at the same place at the same time. And it was just going to be this, like, powder keg. Or it was kind of, like, setting up to be this powder keg. And what's hilarious, like, hilarious in kind of a 20,000-foot level, but oddly enough, the most grisly scene is, A, like, Leo's about to shoot Bobby, like, stalking Bobby. He overhears that Waldo is, for lack of a better term, in custody at the police station, and he shoots Waldo. And, like, the blood on the jelly donut, the light swinging, the broken glass, like, it was oddly, for me, like, one of the most affecting and dramatic scenes was the death of this bird.
That you had just met the previous episode.
Yes. That I just met, but it, like, and I don't know why. Yeah. I guess because, and maybe this is stretching, I don't know, but, like, again, the fact that with the uncanny, with one of the rules, if I can even call it a rule, is, like, if nothing's off the table, then everything is just as important as everything else.
Yeah.
And so yes. A bird is just as viable a witness as James Hurley, say.
Yep. Yep.
And so when you have, like, this break in the case, this bird who is in the cabin when Laura was murdered, like, this is a big deal. Also, like, it's a helpless animal.
Yeah.
And so for Leo, whom I despise, like, I don't like Leo at all. And so for him to just mercilessly kill Waldo, it's just like, good heavens, man.
Yeah, this is the core of Twin Peaks for me, trying to figure out why Waldo's death is so affecting. It happened to Megan as well.
Really?
She was absolutely, she screamed, and it wasn't like a surprise scream. It was a, how can you do this scream?
Yeah.
It's Waldo. Don't kill Waldo.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm joking, it's the core of the Twin Peaks, but no, it really is, in the sense of making small things, not making them seem big, making you realize how big they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I was trying to think about, you know, why is it that Waldo's death is so important and hits you like that? Some of it's the setup beforehand of Waldo becomes a central part of the mystery. So you're kind of trying to get whatever, you know, Waldo is the only witness to Laura's death, it seems.
Right.
And so we are trying to sort that out. We've got a lot of weight put on Waldo. There's also just the way it's kind of cut is there's a lot of tension leading up to it, right? What's going to happen? And you see it coming a long way before it actually happens. Kind of Hitchcock's 38 stairs, 39 stairs. What is it?
39
stairs. You know, that kind of thing where you just keep seeing him get closer and closer and closer. Here it comes. Mm-hmm. He's going to get Waldo. And then to the blood on the jelly donuts, where it's such a great kind of statement of what should be inside is now outside.
Mm.
Right? The jelly has squirted out of the donut. And it fits on the donut. It looks fine because the blood that they used looks like jelly.
Yes.
And so in that moment, it looks like you're just looking at donuts where some of the jelly spilled. And all of that adds up, and just kind of this stacking of meaning and of intentionality that fills these small moments with meaning, so that you know that you're supposed to reflect on them. You know that they're serious and that they mean something. Lynch is really just a master of that, for my money.
Yeah.
It's strange to call him a surrealist in some ways, in that surrealism, I think, often sounds like people don't care about meaning, but he cares a great deal about meaning. It's almost that everything means to him, and there's intense meaning everywhere.
Yeah. Everything having an equal meaning and having an equal depth to it, even if it's the assassination of a bird.
Yeah.
One of the other things for me that stood out was the scene where Maddie meets James and Donna at, I'm blanking on the name of the park right now.
I can't remember it either. Yeah.
Yeah. But she meets them at the park and shows up in a blonde wig. Basically, like, it's exactly almost like a beat for beat homage to Vertigo.
Yep.
with Jimmy Stewart. So again, referencing Hitchcock, but this idea of the doppelganger and this copy, this double coming in, and it like freaked me out because, and obviously, like, James is dumbstruck by how just exactly like spot on Maddie looks like her cousin Laura.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like coming up to the end of this episode, I had no idea where things were going to wind up in the finale, or basically like what direction things were going to go in.
Because it doesn't follow the rules. Like you said,
no.
It creates its own rules as it goes.
Yeah. By this point, like, I was completely entrusted to the show, and to my delight, the show did not let me down whatsoever.
Yeah. Cool. Shall we continue with episode 7 then?
We shall.
Or episode 8, The Last Evening. Under the orders of Ben Horn, Leo embarks on a plan not only to burn the Packard sawmill, but to eliminate Shelley, Catherine Martell, and Bobby Briggs in one fell swoop. Things take a rather violent turn when Agent Cooper successfully lures Jacques Renault across the Canada-US border, and his involvement in the death of Laura is revealed. Nadine decides to end her life, and Laura's father Leland takes the law into his own hands. Later, Cooper gets a nasty surprise on his return to his hotel room at the Great Northern Hotel.
Yeah, so I didn't read... I haven't read any like episode previews or recaps, or even like kind of log lines. Sorry. That came completely by accident.
I understand. My log knows.
I'm just, your log saw it coming.
My log saw it coming.
Yes. The owls knew.
Yeah.
But I haven't read any like episode summaries, and I'm really glad I have not, because this one basically like is more plot synopsis than it is preview.
Yeah.
So I have to make sure that I don't read any like any wiki sites going forward.
Yep.
But this was a fantastic season finale.
Yeah.
There was a great combination of resolving the Jacques Renault plotline, the mill, which has been talked about since the first episode, and the intrigue surrounding the mill, the kind of like machinations of trying to get possession of the mill. The mill's on fire. We end with the mill ablaze. Shelley and Catherine are in the mill, and Pete Martell rushes in to save his wife, and that's where we leave them. And Nadine has OD'd, and we're not sure what's going on with her. Leo's been shot and is, I'm guessing, dead.
Shot for the second time this season, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
For the second time in two episodes.
Mm-hmm. Leo, as much as I don't like him, I do have to admit he's having a rough couple of episodes.
He's getting shot a bunch.
He is. Lucy Lucy is pregnant.
Yep.
And apparently Andy, who saved the day earlier, yeah. Andy did not take it well.
Andy's not handling that really well, is he?
No, no.
Not what you saw coming from Andy.
Yeah. So we have, where else did we leave? Jacques is in the hospital.
Yep.
And Leland Palmer comes in, kills Renaud, basically taking out another witness. So first, in the previous episode, we lose Waldo.
Yep.
And now we lose Jacques Renaud.
Good call. I didn't think about that. Yeah, two witnesses down.
Yeah. And Coop comes back to the Great Northern, gets a note from Audrey, gets a phone call from not sure who, and then gets a knock on the door, opens the door, and is shot.
Yep.
And that's where, and then that's the end of season one.
Yep.
And just like so much happening and so much like, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. And then that's the end of the season. And to its immense credit, two things that I still don't know who killed Laura Palmer.
Yep.
Like, sort of, there is no, like, who killed her? This person. And I'm totally okay with it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think it's simultaneously, I was most worried that I wouldn't know who killed her at the end of the episode or the end of the season. But I'm also totally stoked that, like, I'm in the universe and loving it.
That's awesome. That's
yeah.
I think, my hope. And if that shift doesn't happen for someone who's watching Twin Peaks, you have to shift gears. You get mm-hmm. roped in with the Laura Palmer murder, and then you have to be willing to jump onto these other interesting stories.
Yeah.
And if it's done successfully, I think the way you described the season finale, look at all the cliffhangers we have. We've almost forgotten about who killed Laura Palmer.
Yeah.
Because you care about all these other characters. It's great. It's moving forward. And they're working. And you know these things will be resolved.
Mm-hmm.
And new mysteries will be created. And it's all going to work. But if you reach the end of season one and you say, wait, I thought I was going to find out who killed Laura Palmer, and I'm disappointed, it's going to be real tough to continue with this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, later on, when we talk about season one in hindsight, it did make me think of some more contemporary examples.
Yeah.
That I want to bring up.
All right. Well, we'll do that in a moment.
Yeah.
One thing for me is I think I had forgotten just how many cliffhangers, just how crazy the end of season one is.
Yeah.
In my vague memory of all these events happening, I kind of distributed them over like the end of season one and the beginning of season two.
Mm.
But so much happens right at the tail end there so quickly.
Yeah. I was kind of hoping, but not all disappointed, that we didn't see the Red Room.
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
I'm just like, okay, I just assume that, like, we're going to get back there eventually.
Yeah.
So that was the only thing I was like, or I kind of expected a revisiting, because that felt like almost like a midpoint of season one was that dream.
Yeah.
But yeah, season two, I'm sure. Season two, I predict, is entirely in the Red Room.
Entirely in the Red Room. Yes. Like it.
Yeah.
Let's check out some of your other predictions, because you did text me your predictions.
Yes.
So I want to pull these up. First off, there's the joke ones.
Yeah.
So if I can just go through these real quick. First off, I love this one. Diane is the killer.
Yes.
That's stellar.
Yeah. I still have a chance at that one. That
Absolutely.
One is still yet to be disproven.
Yep. Yep. I don't know what the betting markets are on that, but that's a good one.
Yeah.
Jack will find his other eye.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
That'll happen. And number three, perhaps the most important, the gum finally comes back in style.
Yes. Yes.
So, all right. So on to the serious ones. Here are your predictions.
Okay.
I love these predictions. All right. One, Bobby dies. And do you mean at some point in the future or as a result of what is occurring right now, kind of in the next episode?
Yeah. So that was my prediction for... These were all season one finale predictions.
Oh, so this is before you saw the finale. Got it. Yeah, I see that now. That's right. Okay.
And so I predict, yeah, so Bobby dies, and last time we see Bobby that he leaves Leo.
Yeah. But it was looking real bad for him for a second.
Yes. For a second, I thought Bobby was going to die.
Hank saved Bobby. You were real close to getting that one. Okay, yeah. Two. Agent Cooper kills to save Audrey.
So I was wrong there.
Wrong. Way off. Really solid prediction. I love it.
Yeah. But Audrey is in a very bad scenario at the end of season one. It is dark times at One Eye Jack's.
And the only person who might know she's in there because she left him a note.
Oh, yeah.
The only person who might know that she's in there just got shot.
Oh, man. Ooh.
Just to raise the stakes a bit. All right.
Yeah.
Three. Catherine Martell dies in the mill fire.
Huh?
You might be right. I mean, we don't know.
I might have gotten that one.
So we've got Catherine, Pete, and Shelley are in there.
Yes.
And when you were predicting that, none of them were in the mill fire. I guess Shelley was on her way to the mill fire.
Yes. Yeah.
That was nice. That's a good call predicting that Catherine would die in the mill fire. I mean, I don't think you had the clues to get there, so that's great.
No, I didn't. I was just like, the penultimate episode had a lot of this kind of a gathering feeling. So like pieces were starting to come together and the mill felt like one of those gathering spaces.
Yeah.
So kind of almost like magnetism, just like something was going to happen at the mill and I'm just like, well, Catherine's obviously going to be there. And
that's really interesting. I hadn't ever thought about the way that the mill acted as a magnet to bring people in because so much of Twin Peaks, there's evil in the woods, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing that we know. There's evil in the woods. And there's also good that supports it. The mill is the place that the woods get repurposed for human use, right? We take trees, we put them in. It's the town's lifeblood. It's also kind of a dying industry. It ends up being a metaphor for so many other things. So the idea that everything is going to climax at the mill, that's great. I hadn't thought about it until you started describing it as a magnet that's pulling people towards it.
Yeah. And even like the idea of certain locations being poles of activity.
Yeah.
So like always referencing the double R or always the mill and having these touch points, like just a nexus of locations. There's always something going on at these spaces.
And the spaces themselves seem to have a kind of personality that shape the events that are going to happen there.
Yeah.
For instance, the double R, everything's always civil at the double R.
Yes. Yeah.
There might be tensions. You might see your partner visiting with a former lover, but you're not going to flip over the table.
No.
It's the double R.
Yeah.
You're going to order your coffee. You're going to get some pie.
Mm-hmm.
You know how it works.
Yeah. The Great Northern feels like a minor key funhouse.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like they put on the airs of this wonderful hotel and everyone's having a fantastic time. But there's a lot of betrayal going on. There's a lot of discord, like nothing good, like capital G good for me happens at the Great Northern.
It's a place of chaos.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And chaos can work out in good ways, but it's going to be lowercase good, like you're saying. Absolutely. Especially once Jerry gets there.
He puts
the fun in the fun house.
Jerry is an agent. He is an agent of chaos.
Yeah.
Without question.
Yeah.
Just like irrespective of anyone else.
With his Icelandic girlfriend.
Oh my gosh. Good gracious. Yeah, the Icelandic coalition coming in.
I love that we haven't even talked about them.
Yeah.
There's so much to cover.
So many Icelanders. So little time.
All right, so we've gotten through the episodes. I think we're in a good place. We have by no means covered everything that's in there, but we've gotten a lot out. So let's jump into some of the characters and then some of the themes. Any characters that you wanted to start talking about today or maybe even bring up that we talked about earlier?
Yeah, I continue to be impressed by Agent Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
I was really impressed by the way he addressed Audrey. So the episode ending Cooper's Dreams ends with Audrey in Coop's bed. And we pick up right like the opening episode of the next opening scene of the next episode is Cooper talking to Audrey. and explaining that, you know, what he wants and what has to happen are two different things.
Yeah.
And so able to, in the moment, make a rational decision.
Yeah.
And again, that felt like something small that points to something larger.
Yeah.
And it felt like Lynch point of view on the world, or just being able to, like, that mindset of seeing all things in front of you and being able to have the presence of mind to make the right decision.
He's kind of unrelentingly honest as well. That's one thing that I've noticed on the rewatch. Seen him and Audrey, for instance, and she says something like, oh, but don't you think I'm attractive? Or aren't you attracted to me? And he says, well, that really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with this. Yeah, I think we might say, no, what you should say is, no, I'm not attracted to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no. I have no sense of attraction to you whatsoever. Let's just leave that out.
Yeah.
Whether it's true or not. But the fact that he refuses to do that is just shows a small lie, and one that we could see, you know, protecting someone else in many ways and protecting himself. But he won't even lie for that. He's so concerned and committed to honesty.
Yeah. I think as the show progresses, he stands out more and more because of that commitment.
Yeah.
It's like, it starts as a seemingly small commitment because he's like, oh, like straight arrow G-man, whatever. But the more intertwined and mysterious the characters around him become, the more his fidelity to that stands out.
Absolutely. So how about Audrey, the other person in that conversation? Yeah.
Audrey, it seems like the more she tries to take agency for herself, the more in over her head she gets.
Yeah.
And I guess, like, yeah, going back to your point about teenagers trying to act like adults, it feels like Audrey is trying to express or convey something very tender, but using blunt instruments to do so.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
And so because of that, she's now in a very, like, very dangerous, very strange and potentially traumatic situation.
Yeah.
At One Eye Jack's.
Absolutely. Yeah. She's in over her head. I can't say anything else. I need to be silent, and just see where that leads. All right. What other characters?
I'll say that season one did a remarkable job of keeping everyone at play and keeping, like, touching base with everybody and keeping everyone going. The one character that I feel is sort of like out in the cold right now is Donna Hayward.
Yeah.
I think I lost count at the number of times she said, oh, James.
Oh, James.
And at the beginning, she was Laura's best friend. She was in the video.
Yeah.
That, you know, first you think, okay, she's going to be a central player. And over the course of the episodes, she's had less and less to do. And she, you know, Laura Flynn Boyle went on to become, as far as, like, this, the core of these actors, went on to become one of the more well-known ones.
Right.
But in this season, she seems to be, again, the character with the least amount to do.
Yeah.
I don't really have a lot of predictions for Donna in season two, mostly because it feels like she has nowhere to go.
Yeah. I think we talked last episode about how Coop is the kind of point of view character, right? Mm-hmm. He's the audience surrogate in many ways because he's the outsider.
Yeah.
I think in another sense, Donna's the audience surrogate.
Yeah.
As an insider that's going to guide you, and she's the only insider who seems to, she's the normal insider, the insider who we can identify with.
Yeah.
So she's a different kind of audience surrogate than Coop. And of course, we discover that she actually is fairly normal in a lot of ways. And Coop is pretty weird in a lot of ways.
True.
Especially for an audience surrogate.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. So let's head on to themes then.
Yeah. Themes, I think, like, revisiting what you mentioned in our first couple of episodes, the kind of like that hidden darkness, or what lies beneath the veneer of our daily lives.
Yeah.
And a lot of that coming, like that duplicity coming to fruition.
Yeah.
Whether that be murder, whether that be a mill fire, whether that be, you know, like one-eyed Jacks, whether it be a murder in the hospital, like there is no moderation. There's no kind of like temperate action here.
Right.
Everything is like it is murder. It is deceit. It is like things are falling hard. And it's because a lot of these relationships were built on lies or were built on half truths. And perhaps it is that crack in the veneer with Laura Palmer dying, and then that injection of something true or some like that antidote. So you have that outsider, Agent Cooper, something coming in that really does call out the falseness of everything.
Yeah. In line with that, did I tell you anything about the murder that inspired Twin Peaks?
No.
So Mark Frost, the co-creator.
Yes.
With David Lynch. Frost, again, was the more traditional TV mind on this. He grew up with his grandmother telling him stories. And one of the stories was about a woman who died in upstate New York named Hazel Irene Drew. And she was murdered in 1908. I don't want you to go seek her out because almost everything about her is actually about Twin Peaks.
Okay.
There's just very little kind of original stuff. Yeah. But if you go back and look, you'll see like the picture of her from high school. She's a dead ringer for Laura Palmer.
Wow. Like,
clearly they were thinking about that.
Yeah.
But the amazing thing about the story, the thing that Mark Frost remembered from it, it's not just that it was an unsolved murder and that this is someone who was, you know, prom queen kind of thing, you know, just the good girl, the one everyone loved, that once she had been murdered and the investigation started, they started to discover all of these things about how she was not who she seemed to be. Mm. She had dark secrets. She had all of this other stuff going on. And so that's kind of the core of Twin Peaks, is discovering that beneath the veneer, there's something dark. There's something, really untoward there. And I think the idea that it's not salacious. It's not, let's go find out what's under someone else's veneer. It's the realization that it's under all of us, that America is the veneer. And then, you know, just underneath it, there is something evil and that we need to wrestle with that evil.
Yeah. I just saw it in theaters and highly, highly recommend it. But it's reminiscent. What we're talking about now is reminiscent of kind of a central Stephen King notion where the most dangerous monsters are often the humans.
Yeah.
And in It, for example, sometimes the scariest monsters are the parents.
Yeah.
Are the people. And in Twin Peaks, it's not the evil in the woods. It's not the bookhouse boys taking on specters in the night. It's realizing that Benjamin Horn is one of the most like lying, deceitful, and just like skeezy people that you can imagine.
Yeah.
And Hank has deals with everybody and is lying to his wife, is out for blood, is out for money. But everybody's playing these games with everyone else. And like you said, everyone is more than happy to play the game and put blood, sweat, and tears into a lie.
Yeah, because the lie makes us safe. The lie tells us that it's okay. And the lie makes us think that we're in control. I think that's one of the biggest things.
Which I think is what Audrey falls for.
Yeah.
And I think that's where she finds herself at the end of season one, is totally out of control.
Yep. And I think that's what the illusion of control leads to. Yeah. All right. So before we wrap up, you wanted to connect it to season one in hindsight and connect it to some more contemporary shows.
Yeah. Real quick, a shout out to Snoqualmie, Washington, where a lot of Twin Peaks was shot. That's home to Sean Thompson, our brother in pod, to West Coast Bias.
Say, so, Sean.
Hey, Sean. But yeah, season one of Twin Peaks made me think of season one of two different shows. The Killing, which aired in the early 2010s, and Lost, which aired 2004 to 2010. So The Killing was on AMC and very clearly was aping Twin Peaks. Season one, its promo material was a poster of a girl, and then scrawled in red was "Who killed Rosie Larson?"
Yeah.
So Laura Palmer, Rosie Larson.
Yeah.
It was set in Seattle, Washington. It centered around the murder of a young girl, and season one was leading up to the resolution of that central mystery.
Yep.
And at the end of season one of The Killing, there's an arrest. There's all this evidence pointing to a killer, and you think, great, like, we've solved it, we're done. Except the last two scenes tell you that the evidence was that we used to convict was falsified. Mm. And so we have no idea who killed Rosie Larson. Mm. And that's how season one ended. And people were pissed.
Yeah.
So, like, why was Twin Peaks different? And again, the people around Laura Palmer's murder, the people who were exploring that central mystery, are themselves mysterious.
Yeah.
And they're keeping secrets from each other, sometimes to their own detriment, even if they acknowledge it.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's that unique human trait of acknowledging, like, yeah, it's wrong, but I do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is something very mysterious. And The Killing was a TV show that built itself up around a mystery, always around the mystery, always around the mystery, and then basically betrayed the audience by not answering the mystery.
Yeah.
And this isn't to say, like, there's no shame in answering a question. Like, if you set yourself up in that storytelling vein of there's a mystery, we don't know what happened, it's okay if you answer it. Like, there's no shame in doing that. You wind up hurting yourself and angering the audience when you pose that as the aim of it and then wind up on a completely different track.
Right.
Whereas, like, Twin Peaks more and more is feeling like the exploration of a universe,
mm-hmm.
but more locally an exploration of the self.
Yeah. Yeah. The human experience. Yeah. Absolutely. No, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And for me, the reason I think of Lost, obviously Damon Lindelof, one of the showrunners of Lost, is a huge Twin Peaks fan, a huge David Lynch fan. The end of season one, you're dealing with another kind of, like, central mystery. You know, what's in the hatch? There's this mysterious hatch that's been built up. We don't know what's inside. We don't know what it could be. They blow the door off the hatch at the end of season one, and you reveal a whole other set of mysteries. You know, the shot descends inside where you're not quite sure, but we're just exploring a whole other set of mysteries. And so the resolution opens up the universe that much more.
Yeah.
And I think whatever questions Twin Peaks answers, it does so to open up the universe a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't narrow anything. It just makes things more expansive.
I like that. I like that a lot. I definitely can't end it any better than that. So I'll send us out with that. Thanks again for joining us on What Exactly Am I Watching Here? For next week, we're going to be kicking off season two. So Dom, watch the first four episodes. I'm going to have to ask you to stop at episode four, no matter how badly you may want to continue binging, so that we've got those nice breaks for the episodes.
All right.
Yeah. Go give yourself a present. Start your journey into season two. And then get a hold of us on Twitter, where our handle is OverthinkPod. And find more at OverthinkPod.com. We will talk to you later. Meet you in the Red Room.
I'm Dominic, and I have the pictures to prove it.